This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Treatment Room podcast with your host, Tessa Zolli. I am so excited. We're about to have a conversation unlike any we've had before on the show. I'm so excited to welcome my guest, Dr. Yug Varma, who is the co-founder and CEO of Phyla, the world's most advanced probiotic acne system. Dr. Yug, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Tessa. Great to be here, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you. I would love to start asking if you could share a little bit more about your background. I know you have pretty extensive experience working in bioorganic chemistry, so we would love to hear about that. We have an audience of a lot of estheticians and skincare, I'd say, aficionados. So we'd love to hear about your background.
Yeah, absolutely. So my background is that I'm a scientist. I got my PhD at Johns Hopkins, and then I did a postdoc UCSF. I've been studying the microbiome for about 13 years now, and it's a very young field. So I've been really privileged, I think, to be at the forefront of a lot of the cutting edge discoveries and breakthroughs that have informed how the microbiome affects our health. As I said, I've been studying the microbiome for 13 years. I've been interested in the foundational technology of my company for even longer. And that's really what kind of pushed me to move on from more than a decade in academia to starting this company.
Amazing. For anybody who's not really familiar with the scientific term microbiome, could you share what that means?
Yeah. The way I like to describe it, most of us don't realize that we have a rainforest within our body. And the reason this rainforest is so easy to overlook is because it's invisible. Its trees are made up of bacteria, viruses, and fungi. And these microbes together form a tight-knit community called the microbiome. So we have microbes in our gut. That's our gut microbiome. We have them in our mouth, the oral microbiome, and we have them on our skin. And in each of these sites, our microbiome, what we've learned is that our microbiome is working day in and day out to keep us healthy and to prevent us from being sick. And so a lot of microbiome research has focused on what we can do to keep our microbiome healthy, balanced, and diverse. And secondly, what happens when there are changes, perturbations, imbalances in the microbiome that cause a number of diseases. We're, of course, really familiar with the gut, where you can get IBD, IBS, Crohn's disease. You can get a C. diff infection and many others. But on the skin, it may be news to some of your listeners that acne, eczema are primarily driven by imbalances in your microbiome.
Yeah, I feel like it's almost like you can see my questions. I wanted to ask, as a scientist who's studied this, have you seen actual differences when you're looking at a skin that has maybe eczema or rosacea or acne? Like, are you seeing physical differences maybe looking under a microscope?
I mean, science has come such a long way. And really the reason the microbiome research has taken off in the last 20 years has been the advent of some really cutting edge technologies like next generation sequencing, where you can just take a swab of someone's microbiome, a sample of their microbiome, and you can figure out all the different kinds of DNA that are in there and then assign them to the organism that it came from. And so then you're getting an unbiased snapshot of what's going on. And that's given us a lot of insight. And I'll just give you an example. For eczema, we know that Staphylococcus aureus, or Staph aureus, which, you know, a lot of people have heard of, is the offending organism. It's not supposed to be on your skin. For people with eczema, it's on their skin at a much higher level. And more specifically, when they get a flare-up, when their eczema is really bad and inflamed and itchy, the Staph aureus on that region of their skin explodes. It's called a bloom. It grows really out of control and causes all of this inflammation. And actually, there was a more recent paper that came out in the last month that showed that Staph aureus is not just associated with eczema, but it's associated with all sorts of itch. So if you have itchy skin, a lot of the time Staph aureus is a culprit. And so keeping those levels of that bacteria down is really important. Coming to acne, which we'll probably be talking about for the rest of the podcast, acne is caused by an imbalance in our microbiome. And when your immune system detects that, it sends out inflammation. And the pimples and zits and redness that you see with acne is just that inflammation on your skin. Now, people have done studies looking at healthy microbiomes and acne microbiomes and trying to figure out, can we pick out a difference? They couldn't really find out a difference, except there's one organism that's on healthy skin that's not on acne skin. That organism is a phage, or a bacteriophage, that specifically kills and eats acne bacteria. And it doesn't actually kill any other kind of bacteria on your skin. It just kills that. Now, the acne bacteria have been known to be implicated in acne for almost a century. We've known for a very long time that this one bacteria, C. acnes, causes acne. And to find an organism that kills just this bacteria and is present on healthy skin versus absent on acne skin leads to a very interesting thought. We all have annoying friends who their skin's amazing. They never wash their face, but they somehow never got acne in their life.
Yes.
And we look at them we look at them with envy and we say, hey, what am I doing wrong? Why did God choose me? I want to have that kind of skin. Well, chances are those friends of ours with perfect skin have these phages on their skin naturally. And because we didn't have it by an accident of birth or circumstance, we are now condemned to suffer through acne. So what if we democratize this organism, made it available to everyone so they could make their microbiomes more balanced in the way that their friends with perfect skin do, and do it effortlessly? And that was kind of why the company started.
Wow. Okay. I want to make sure I really understand everything you're saying. I know with acne, so we talk about in my industry, aesthetics, we talk about this condition in the sense that somebody with acne-prone skin is producing excess skin cells in the pore. They're also producing a level of oil, which can become a problem. And then you're saying the bacterial component is, would you say it's just as strong as these other factors, or maybe one of the biggest?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Taking a step back, obviously, we all know that acne is a complex, multifactorial disease. And it's affected by things like diet, hormones, stress, genetics, all of these, right? And even the factors that you mentioned, like overproduction of skin cells, the clogging of pores, the excess production of sebum, all of these are factors. But all of these factors are actually supporting the overgrowth of this one bacteria on your skin. This bacteria is actually quite unusual. It is called C. acnes, or Cutibacterium acnes, and it is a very anaerobic and lipid-loving or fat-loving bacteria. So it doesn't live on the surface of our skin. It actually lives deep inside our pores. When it's deep in your pores, it actually still grows quite a bit on your skin, but it doesn't overgrow to the point where you have acne. What starts off this cascade, and I'm sure you know the four steps of acne pathogenesis. The first one is clogging of the pores. The second is overproduction of oil. The third is overgrowth of bacteria. And the fourth is inflammation that leads to acne. So the first two factors are really important, because once you clog the pore, you're creating anaerobic, oxygen poor environments that this one bacteria needs to grow. Then you have oil production. Now, this bacteria, above all other bacteria on our skin, is uniquely adapted and evolved to live on our fatty sebum, the oil that our skin produces, above all else. And it does this better than any other bacteria on our skin. So now you've given it a nice cozy home without oxygen. You've given it a lot of food. The only thing it will do is overgrow. And that's what leads to acne. And so although things like diet, stress, hormone, genetics are part of the causes of acne, they are secondary causes. And they all support the primary cause, which is the overgrowth of bacteria.
Okay. I'm interested to ask you, what would be kind of the difference between the gut microbiome and the skin microbiome? Because I think both can be at play when it comes to acne as a condition. I do see quite a lot of clients who've had some sort of gut dysbiosis, whether it is SIBO or some other gut issue or even a history of a lot of antibiotics. How is that at play when it comes to acne, and what's just different when you're looking at skin microbiome versus the gut?
We talk about the gut and the skin microbiome as, I think of them as a rainforest, and they're like different ecologies, right? So for example, plants grow in many different scenarios. There are plants in the desert, plants in the grassland, there's plants in a rainforest, and there's plants at the bottom of the sea. And they're all different environments, all uniquely adapted to where they live. And so, for example, the gut microbiome is made up mostly of bacteria that are anaerobic or can grow in the lack of oxygen, can ferment a number of fibers and foods that kind of come down as we eat food. Skin microbiome is, the skin is a very kind of dry, nutrient poor, acidic environment. And so the bacteria that grow there are very, very different from the gut bacteria. And with the exception of C. acnes, actually, they're all aerobic bacteria. They love the air because the skin is exposed to so much air. And so it's really like looking at two different kinds of plants, one that grows grassland or the desert and one that grows in the rainforest. Now, how are they connected? How does acne affect all of these and is affected by all of them? We know that there's a gut-skin axis, which means that the gut microbiome and the skin microbiome are connected or have some sort of crosstalk between each other. This has been uncovered for certain skin conditions like psoriasis much more than it has for acne. And as of right now, we don't really have a lot of insight into whether the gut microbiome affects the acne directly. But that's not to say that gut issues do not affect the skin. I guess what I'm trying to say is that we talked about diet being a factor in acne. And to be sure, everyone with acne doesn't have a problem with their diet in the sense they're not lying. There are these kind of urban myths of, oh, if you eat pizza and you have acne, then your face will look like a pizza and stuff, right? And for some people, of course, that's true. That doesn't mean everyone that has acne, like the pizza that they're eating is a cause of their acne. So what's happening is that when you eat certain foods, and people who have diet as a component of their acne have certain trigger foods, whether it's spicy food or chocolate or oily food, whatever it is. When they eat that food, the skin, their body reacts by producing more oil on their skin, right? And you're just serving up more food for your bacteria. The bacteria overgrow, you get acne. And also as a result, I think a lot of people think, oh, the lever here is drying out your skin. If you dry out your skin, you're going to deprive the bacteria of their food so they can't overgrow. That's absolutely true. But what you're ignoring there is that the oil that your skin produces has a certain function. It lubricates your skin cells. It provides an important moisture barrier so your skin cells don't lose moisture and your skin layers remain supple. And also, it prevents premature aging, right? So you get fine lines and wrinkles much more if your skin is drier than if you moisturize and take care of your skin. And so when you're stripping the skin of a lot of this moisture and depleting it of its natural oils, you're actually doing kind of long-term damage that unfortunately isn't evident until you get older, and then it's far too late. And so I would caution against overdrying your skin. And of course, paying attention to your diet, and especially if it affects your acne, is really important. You must understand that part of your body and metabolism. But it's not the case for everyone, and this is really how they're linked.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Do you feel it's important for somebody who is struggling with acne to really focus on eating whole foods and trying to eat a diverse diet with a lot of different types of fruits, proteins, healthy fats, fiber-rich foods, those kind of things?
Absolutely. And not just for your skin health, but for your overall health, right? That's never going to be a negative. And to that, I would add, drink a lot of water, right? Hydration is key to making your skin look less lifeless and dull. And then get a good amount of sleep. One of the easiest ways, if you're not getting enough sleep, to perk up your skin is to have a regular bedtime and get your 8 or so hours of sleep.
This is a little bit of a out of left field question, but I'm just curious, since you are a doctor and you also have this unique experience with the microbiome, have you seen acne medications like maybe Accutane or spironolactone affecting gut health in the long term?
There have been anecdotal, or I think there have been some case studies as well that have been published showing that, I mean, Accutane, it does a real number on your body, right?
Right.
The side effects of Accutane are so long, including birth defects, liver damage, joint pain, inflammation, and up to and including depression and suicide. And so it really is a very powerful and I would say very risky drug to take for your acne. And so anyone considering it should be totally prepared and fully cognizant of what it will do to you. Of course, not to say that it's not effective or that people shouldn't take it, because obviously there are people for whom it is the only effective thing that they've found.
Right.
And it becomes a very important part of them healing their skin. We're trying to provide an alternative to, if you look at all of the products that are used to treat acne, all come with sizable amount of side effects, whether it's redness, dryness, irritation, sun sensitivity, etc., or dysbiosis. And so with Accutane, what has been found is that there are some gut issues. They're not the major side effects, but they do happen in many people. With spironolactone, I think the side effects obviously are less severe than Accutane, but you do have side effects that can be concerning.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then specifically, I wanted to talk to you about antibiotics. I'm sure you have an interesting opinion of this type of medication. I see so many clients who, if they have tried the dermatologist route before coming to see me, most of them have used some sort of antibiotic, whether it's a topical clindamycin or oral doxycycline, something like that. How do you see antibiotics affecting the microbiome of the gut and the skin? And do you think there is a place for them when it comes to treating acne?
I think that's a really important question, especially for aestheticians and folks who are treating acne, because obviously share some broad information that they know of and then share some information they might not be aware of. So my impression is, whether you look at benzoyl peroxide or antibiotics or retinoids or like Accutane, they all kill bacteria, right? They all have a bactericidal part of them. And antibiotics, obviously, it's a big part. This, I think, it reflects on the fact that the main cause driving acne is bacterial overgrowth, right? But the problem is, when you apply these products, they do not kill only the bad bacteria. They kill the good bacteria as well. And because they're killing both, we talked about the microbiome being this protective layer, this rainforest, that when it's diverse and in balance, it keeps you healthy. When you have an imbalanced microbiome, when you have overgrowth of C. acnes, and you treat it in this way with antibiotics that kill everything on your skin, then you're not just sort of setting fire to this rainforest, but you're also depleting this very important protective layer. And that's what happens, because the most common experience of an acne sufferer is that they get acne relapses, right? I guess other than the side effects. So you try a product, it works for a couple of months, you're really excited. It's a little harsh, but hey, you're getting results. And then it stops working and you're frustrated. You've spent all this effort and time. You feel like you're back at square one and you don't know what to do. And at this point, you've depleted your microbiome, so you're much more susceptible to these relapses. And that's really what's happening. It's a cycle of you're thinning out your microbiome. It's no longer able to protect you, so that when you stop taking this product because it's too harsh or you think you've cured your acne, it comes roaring back. Now, what's interesting is in the 90s, or I think early 2000s, they had done a good sort of comprehensive study of how effective are antibiotics on specifically killing C. acnes, because that was always the target. And they found that there was an alarming rise in the resistance to antibiotics within this group. So the acne bacteria were getting more and more resistant to antibiotics. And the Acne and Rosacea Society, with the primary society for acne in America, has actually had a series of conferences and symposia just discussing this fact that we haven't looked for about 20 years what the current state of antimicrobial resistance to C. acnes is. And they're worried that antibiotics may be close to completely useless right now, because there's so much resistant C. acnes on everyone's skin that throwing antibiotics at this is pretty much a waste of time. And so I guess I don't have a clear answer for you, but these are some of the concerns in the community.
Yeah, no, I think that's really valuable information. I see this resistance a lot in my practice, and I talk to a lot of clients who say they were using the clindamycin and it worked great in the beginning for 3 months or so. And then at a certain point, it really stopped working and giving them much benefit. But it seems it is kind of just such a wide practice of prescribing this topical that, I mean, it seems like a pretty short-term solution to me with long-term consequences.
Exactly. And what I've left unsaid, I guess, which most people would be aware of, is that when you take systemic antibiotics, right? So when you're popping an antibiotic pill, it's affecting your gut. And for some people, it leads them with a different kind of dysbiosis in their gut that then they have to deal with. And so it really is kind of this scattershot approach. And again, I'm not saying antibiotics are terrible for everything. They're obviously a miracle of public health in the 20th century. But I think the time has come to really evaluate where we use antibiotics and to see if there are other tools we can use so that we can reserve antibiotics for really the most dire situations where they're needed the most, without overexposing them to bacteria and leading to this rampant drug resistance.
Yeah. And I would also ask, so beyond the individual kind of getting used, their microbiome getting used to the antibiotic and it no longer working, are there potential consequences for the wider population when it comes to if a lot of people are taking antibiotics for many different things, like as a society, is that harmful for the bacteria population on the whole?
Yeah, the more antibiotics we use and overuse, the greater the chance that these bacteria will become resistant to them and our antibiotics will no longer work. And we're already seeing that, where a lot of ink has been spilled on the alarm that we might be entering a pre-antibiotic era, where a kid could get a scratch on a playground and they could potentially be hospitalized or even die from it, because a simple bacterial infection could now be untreatable with the antibiotics we have. And because we've kind of discovered all the low-hanging fruit, the remaining antibiotics that we can and do develop are ones that have a lot of side effects, are not as useful, and no matter what, after a couple of years, a new antibiotic will start to see resistance. So antibiotic stewardship and husbandry is really, really important. And for things like acne, where maybe better solutions are necessary, and especially for chronic diseases, right? A disease that is with you for months and years, you cannot use antibiotics because it just doesn't work for public health. And so it's really important for us. That's one of the motivating factors for me, is to develop phages and phage therapies or phage solutions for these kinds of conditions where they're chronic, they're caused by bacteria, and that antibiotics are just a bad fit for them.
Why do you think it remains so commonplace for doctors to continue prescribing antibiotics? I mean, it seems like very casual and kind of just like the first off recommendation. And you would think with more information coming out and just with more understanding of how important probiotics are, you would think maybe they would be more carefully prescribed, but it just still seems so rampant. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a couple of factors. I think the first one is obviously microbiome research is a very new field. And although we've made a lot of really interesting discoveries, it takes time to translate those discoveries into products, right? So although I go to dermatologist conferences and I talk to them all the time and they're like, yeah, I've heard of the microbiome and I'm very aware of it and I'm really interested in it, but there aren't any microbiome-based products that are science-based on the market that I would recommend to my patients and say, hey, you should take this for your health because it does a specific thing to your microbiome and that's good, right? So we're, I think, one of a small but hopefully rapidly growing category of products where the science is there. It's very compelling, makes a definitive change in your microbiome, and it has a specific, you know, positive impact. And the other factor, honestly, is they have no choice. What are their choices? You have a patient coming in the door, their acne is pretty severe and concerning. They've probably taken benzoyl peroxide, azelaic acid, all of the drugstore brands. And so you're saying, okay, I'll combo that. I'll have a combo of benzoyl peroxide and antibiotics, or I can go straight to Accutane. Or obviously there's spironolactone and stuff, and those have side effects as well. And those are useful or in specific circumstances. Or you have, for women, you prescribe birth control to control their hormones and their acne. So they don't have a lot of highly precise solutions. And I would say until now, because what we're doing is trying to give both patients and doctors or prescribers, or obviously a product is not a prescription product, but give them another modularity, another way to affect their acne that doesn't have side effects, that doesn't give them collateral damage, doesn't damage their microbiome, and really puts them on a path to healthy skin for life.
Yeah, I would love to talk a little bit more about some of the new technology in this area of microbiome research. And I don't know if it's similar, but I'm seeing a lot of, I guess, buzz and popularity around certain ingredients or technologies. Like, I think probiotic skincare has been something I've seen, or products like hypochlorous acid, which, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it does address bacteria, maybe doesn't wipe out everything. Are those kind of remedies possibly beneficial in this arena?
Yeah. So we've discussed that bacterial overgrowth is the number one cause of acne. It's really the root cause. And whether it is other different factors that cause acne, things like diet or oily skin, they're the heart of it affecting bacterial overgrowth. And the second part of it is that all of the products that we use to kill or to cure acne kill bacteria, right? They're all antibacterial. There are a couple of other kind of pieces of evidence here, right? The first is that you'll never get acne on your knee or your elbow or on your belly. And that's because the bacteria that live there are different from the bacteria that live on your skin. And so C. acnes, the acne bacteria, really lives on your face, on your upper chest and your upper back. And that's where you get acne. The second is that you don't get acne when you're like a little kid, right? 6-year-olds don't get acne. You start getting acne at puberty. And the reason is that before then, you don't have very much C. acnes colonization on your skin at all. They're not really on your skin. It's only after puberty, when your oil glands activate, your pores get deeper, that becomes the ideal bed for C. acnes. And so when we're thinking of things like hypochlorous acid, I'm very interested in that product. I think it's mostly marketed towards people who have sensitive skin and eczema skin. I haven't really seen it in the context of acne, but I'd be very interested in what people's experiences are, because it is basically an antibacterial and it is produced. It's a little misleading to say that it's produced in our skin cells. It's actually produced inside our cells in lysosomes and stuff. So that's just a correction. I have a bit of a problem with probiotic skincare. Unfortunately, the words probiotic skincare and even the microbiome are often used as throwaway marketing terms by companies that want to make the most of a trend, right? It's a little disappointing, because if we start to make customers doubt the word or the power of the word or what it means by misusing it and deliberately using it as devaluing its meaning, I think that's a big disservice, not just to ourselves, but to our customers and to the field in general. because the microbiome holds so much promise that to cheapen it like this is really something that I find frustrating. Now,
yeah.
What is probiotic skincare and how do you spot the real thing versus the fake, right? So probiotic skincare, obviously there are bacteria on our skin. I've read that there are 3 times more bacteria on our skin than there are skin cells on our like topmost layer. So they're a substantial member of that community. Putting bacteria on your skin for health purposes, great idea. However, most of the bacterial strains that are used in probiotic skincare are ones that are used for gut health, right? Lactobacillus, bifidobacterium, etc. It's kind of like taking seaweed from the bottom of the ocean and planting it in soil and then saying, hey, this is a plant. I'm giving it soil. I'm giving it air. Why is it not growing? Well, seaweed grows really well in the sea. It's not meant to grow on land, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same thing of taking these lactic acid bacteria that are meant to thrive in the gut and then putting them on our skin. It's not going to do anything. I'm not saying it's harmful, but, and your mileage may vary, but I really don't see much evidence of it doing much good. On top of that, most of probiotic skincare does not have probiotics because they are not alive, right? And the way to spot that is if probiotic ingredient in your product is a ferment or a lysate or an extract, it is dead ground up bacteria. So I don't know what your expectation is, but I wouldn't expect it to do very much for my skin.
Yeah. When I worked at a medical spa, I would have a lot of patients using, it's a very popular brand. I'd say it's a very influencer targeted brand. And a lot of people would be using it and they'd be so convinced by the idea of the probiotic skincare. But I would just tell them, I really don't see it giving you any benefit. Like we haven't seen anything at all from the results of using it. So I see what you're saying and how it could be so frustrating that people would take the concept of the microbiome and kind of dilute it and misuse it.
Yeah.
I would love to continue talking about probiotics. I think it's definitely a big area of interest for people. And I think a lot of people are invested in their gut health. And even on that note, I think I'm seeing a lot of just products being marketed to customers for the purpose of gut health. How can we kind of distinguish somebody saying this greens powder is for gut health and de-bloating? How can we make decisions as consumers as to whether that's going to help us, or when we're looking at probiotics, how do we know which one may actually be legitimate and helpful?
Yeah, you know, when it comes to gut health, it's so bewildering that you hear almost every time you open the news, you see, oh, this diet that we thought was good is bad for us, or this particular keto was good, then it's bad, and veganism was good, and then you're like, oh, or, you know, impossible foods, impossible burger was good, now it's not so good. When it comes to nutrition and gut health, I think Michael Pollan's rules are really great. What is it? It says, eat moderately. It's basically like eat mostly plants, eat whole foods, not too much, mostly plants. I think that's it. So it's saying don't eat too much, eat whole foods. So eat as many things from the market. When you go to a supermarket, you should come back and your compost bin should be full and your garbage can and your recycling should be close to empty, right? Mm. Don't buy prepackaged foods. Don't buy processed and ultra processed foods. If you want fiber, it's far better to eat a carrot than to drink carrot juice, or eat an apple rather than drink apple juice or a smoothie even. They have different ways to pass through your body. And the more you go just to source and eat simply like we used to 50, 60 years ago before ultra processed and canned food became the norm, the better off you will be.
That's probably difficult for the average person since when you go into the store, most of it is packaged or processed in some way. What about you, Dr. Yug? When you're going to the market, are there maybe like 5 things or a couple of things you're picking up? Or what are you even thinking about when you're going to the store? Are you trying to pick up one beneficial food regularly, or are you trying to switch it up often?
I'll tell you that I love to cook. I love to eat. And so I do a lot of cooking. I do all the cooking in my house and I'm always like messing around with stuff. Also, given my scientific background, I also do a lot of fermentation. So I brew beer, I make wine, I make infusions and I make bitters and I make all sorts of fermented foods from yogurt to kefir to sauerkraut and kimchi and stuff. So that's just my interest. But when I go to the supermarket, I try to fill up mostly on a few things. The first is vegetables, right? And I think now is one of the best times to be vegetarian because you can choose not just meat and potatoes or say, oh, I can't eat meat. Should I just eat potatoes? But you can have things with condiments from Asia and Africa, all sorts like the Mediterranean and Northern Europe. Everyone's social feeds or whatever kind of media you consume, I'm sure there's a healthy dose of here's a delicious recipe for this or that. So vegetables are really important. The fiber in them is really important. I also love fruits. So I pick up a lot of fruits and I eat a lot of fruits. So after dinner or after a meal, I usually enjoy a piece of fruit or two. And then what I think is really important is fermented foods. And whether it's yogurt or sauerkraut or kimchi, I think it's far more beneficial to consume probiotics in that form than to take a pill. And I'll also give you an example. So when I was at UCSF, one of my colleagues was trying to basically clone a gene out of this one bacteria. And he saw that the bacteria, he'd have to get it from Germany. It would take months. And he was, can I get this faster? And he found that he could go out that very day to a CVS and purchase this pill that said on the label, it has this particular strain of bacteria that he wanted. So he went out, got this pill, took out the powder, and it should have the bacteria, which means it should have the DNA material. And so he could pull out the gene from there. He tried for, I think, 3 months and he couldn't do it. And he said, I was starting to lose, because this is a pretty straightforward thing in science. It's a very simple procedure. And he said, I was starting to feel like a failure. I felt like I couldn't do this very simple step. And then our PI, our boss, said, hey, why don't you just like sequence it and see what's in that powder? And it turned out this one strain that they had advertised would be in their cocktail of probiotics was not there at all. It was
Wow. Because supplements aren't regulated. Is that why?
Yeah, it's a shockingly underregulated space. And the FDA is not coming after these guys anytime soon. So if they slip up or a batch, and you don't even know how many batches are they just consistently dropping this strain from their list. And so it just goes on to show that probiotics in a pill, yeah, they're fine, they're great, but they're also processed in a certain kind of way. The best way is to go to the source. Eat yogurt.
Okay. Okay.
You put in everything.
And do you feel eating probiotics, is that more transient and maybe short term in terms of benefits compared to a supplement? Like, would you need to just continually do that every day, eat probiotics? Or how would you kind of compare the long-term benefits of both types, food and supplement probiotics?
Yes, for both of them. If you want to see an effect for the long term, you have to take it regularly. And so I think many probiotic pills are twice a day. It's the same thing with probiotics. If you have yogurt twice a day, and you can just have it with your food, right? I mean, you can have it on the side of a meal. You can have it at the end of a meal, but it's recommended that you have it twice a day.
And this might be a naive question, but can you just share like why it's so important to have probiotics in your diet?
Yeah. So we think that you have a probiotic, it's a living bacteria. It goes into your gut and it should then grow there forever. And that's true. And there are certain bacteria that if you take them, they will take up permanent residence in your gut. However, the class of bacteria that we use that are present in probiotics, they're called the lactic acid bacteria because they produce lactic acid. And this includes lactobacillus, bifidobacterium. There are a few other clades. These are all transient colonizers of your gut. So you eat them, they stick around for a little while, maybe a few days, up to a few days, but then they disappear or they basically become very small parts of the community. And so they're doing stuff. They're producing happy molecules that make your gut healthy, that make your gut happy. But if they're not around, you're not getting that benefit. And that's why you need to continue to use these fermented foods and eat them regularly. And by the way, we've co-evolved with these, right? So the use of fermented foods in food is very ancient. And it probably predates civilization itself. And so we have co-evolved with these organisms. We're meant to find these and consume them regularly over time in small quantities to maintain gut health.
I'm curious too, because there's some companies that have great reputations that are doing a lot of clinical studies and even dermatology research with their probiotics. Do you think some of them are pretty legitimate? And like, is it possible that these strains are even helpful to a wide audience? Or do you think it really is more bio-individual where you need to be finding the specific strain that could work for you?
I think by and large, many of these products and these strains are broadly beneficial to people. However, obviously there are people who have quite a bit of sensitivity or allergies, or I wouldn't say allergies, but their body just cannot react the same way to a lot of a broad swath of these strains. And in that case, they have to tread a little more carefully and do a little bit of discovery to figure out what works with my gut and what doesn't. And what I would say is that it's likely that their microbiome is out of balance and there's something in their microbiome that isn't playing well with probiotics. So I guess the problem is a little deeper than that. Mm. So for most people, I would say they will get huge benefits by just incorporating probiotics regularly in their diet. For some people who have an extraordinary sensitivity, they would have to tread more carefully and find maybe like that subset of products or strains that do them good without producing the bad side effect.
Sure. Can I ask about candida and that kind of, I guess, sugar-based, would it be correct to say sugar-based inflammation that can affect the skin and the gut? Like, what is going on there?
Yeah, I mean, candida over a population is just another kind of microbial dysbiosis, right? So your microbiome is off center, it is unbalanced, and your body detects that and it sends out inflammation to try to correct it. And when you do have a candida kind of infestation or implantation in your microbiome, then it becomes really difficult because when you consume refined sugars and stuff, it promotes the overgrowth of those. And it's the same thing with things like SIBO, where you have an overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine, where you really shouldn't see a ton of bacteria. And so that causes a lot of problems. And then I remember a professor at UCSF who was in studying the microbiome said, it turns out we are literally what we eat. And by that, he meant that if you eat a vegetarian diet, you will very quickly have the microbiome of someone who's been vegetarian all their life. And if you start eating meat very quickly, your microbiome starts to resemble someone who's eaten like heavy amounts of meat their whole life. So the microbiome is actually quite adaptable and quite plastic to whatever you send down it. But it's when you're eating, you're not just feeding yourself, you're also feeding your microbiome. So in that sense, you become what you eat. So it's a kind of a fascinating way of thinking of ourselves, that we're always taking care of this organism with this super organism within our body, which kind of works independently, but which we depend on for our health.
I think you have kids, right, Dr. Yug?
Yeah, I have two boys.
Okay. Having kids, I'm just curious, I think this will be my last question for you, but like, what are you thinking about in terms of your, like, how, what you're conscious of with the microbiome and bacteria? Like, are there things you're thinking about raising your kids when it comes to the microbiome and having, a healthy one?
Yeah. So I have twin boys and, as a scientist, it's kind of hard not to run that perfect experiment with its own control. But, since they were young, I've always like observed them, and being sort of a biochemist, had that in the back of the mind of like, when the kids are young, their skin sometimes smells different when they're like little. They have these folds in their skin that become really, really stinky. What's going on with that? And then that passes. And then one of them waking up in the morning, his breath smells different from his brother. So I always had all these questions about I wonder what's going on. And I talked to my colleagues who are working on like the oral microbiome or the skin microbiome or whatever. And you're obviously, when your kids are in diapers, you're seeing a lot of poop and you're like, oh, that's different. That's interesting. They both ate the same meal, but this person's poop is different than the others. And so that's my scientist brain kind of ticking over in the background.
But
which I was also aware of the hygiene hypothesis, which is this observation that people in like post-industrial communities have incredible kind of high amounts of asthma, allergies, and so on, especially young kids growing up, right?
Right. They're
fascinating studies. So on the border of Finland and Russia, on the Finnish side, there is like a city, a town that's more urban. And on the Russian side, same ethnicity, same people eating the same foods, but they live on a farm and they have farm animals and they're more rural. And on the Finnish side, the incidence of allergies and asthma is much, much higher than the same people living on a farm. So I was aware of that. And so when my kids would go to the playground, you got to let them play. You got to let them get dirty. You got to let them get in that sandpit. And if they happen to eat like a fistful of sand, they will not do that again. And it's far better than telling them 1,000 times, don't eat sand. They eat sand. They'll be like, yeah, you're right. I shouldn't do that. But exposed to these microbes at the right time in your life is really what sets your immune system correctly. It sets to the right level. And it's so important.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many more kids who are having autoimmune issues now, and even allergies are just becoming so prevalent. I'm just so interested in how all of that originates and where it really starts and why.
Yeah. And there are things like autism that have an interesting microbiome component. And we're still pretty early in understanding whether it's a cause or an effect or how that affects autism. But autistic kids are on the spectrum always or very often have digestion issues. And there are certain bacteria that produce certain molecules that have been found to be overabundant in autistic kids' guts versus regular. So it's really fascinating because obviously we'll learn more as we go along with science, but there are all these questions that I'm just really curious to hear the answer to.
Me too. I could definitely have you on another time because I have so many questions I could ask you, but I want to be respectful of your time. So I want to say thank you so much for joining us and just ask, is there anything you haven't gotten to share that you'd like to share with us?
We have we ran a clinical trial on acne using phages, the technology that we have in our company, but that information is also on our website. I guess the last thing I will say is I know that your podcast is very popular amongst estheticians and folks in the field. And so if your listeners have heard anything interesting that they'd like to follow up on professionally, I would love to hear from them. I love talking about the science, obviously, but I talk to a lot of doctors and estheticians and PAs and so on. At the end of most of our conversations, they're like, wow, this is really interesting. How did I not know of this? How have I never heard about this approach before? And I say to them, hey, we're trying to change that. That's why I'm talking to you. And we're trying to take it one doctor at a time or one provider at a time. And so I'm really curious to hear from your listeners who may want to learn more about our science. You can reach us through our website or you can reach me directly. My email is yug@phylobiotics.com. It's first name YUG@phylobiotics.com.
Perfect. Well, I'll be sure to link your information in the show notes so that anybody can reach out who wants to. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing all of this great information.
Thanks, Tessa. I really enjoyed my conversation with you.
Oh, thanks so much. We'd love to have you back. Guys, thanks so much for listening. Please let me know what you think of this episode. Be sure to share on social media, and I'll be back in 2 weeks for another episode. Thanks so much, Dr. Yug.
Thanks, Tessa.
Thank you.